watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The Bush administration has declared 2002 another year of war and is planning to mount attacks on more oil-producing nations under the rubric of combating terrorism. High on the list of possible enemies is Iraq, with the current president's father's administration, followed by the Clinton administration, pursued a similar course. Tonight on Unwelcome Guests, we'll explore U.S. policy toward Iraq, both its stated and unstated motivations. First, we'll hear a talk by former U.N. sanctions administrator in Iraq, Dennis Halliday, who resigned his post in protest against the conditions imposed on the Iraqi people. Then, Fred Wilcox of Ithaca College will comment on his agreements and disagreements with Halliday's analysis. We'll conclude with an excerpt of a talk by Professor Noam Chomsky, analyzing the credibility of U.S. government justifications for the decade-long war against Iraq.
No fat rich man's pony can ever overtake you. There's not a rider from the east to the west to hold you alive in this darkness and midnight when the pot-bellied beast chase their unwelcome guests.
Former United Nations official Dennis Halliday spoke earlier this month at a forum at Ithaca College about U.S. and U.N. policy toward Iraq. What he saw during his assignment there so outraged his sense of decency that he abandoned his 34-year UN career to become an advocate in the West for the plight of the Iraqi people.
Dennis Halliday graduated from Trinity College in Dublin. He joined the UN in 1964 as a junior professional officer after serving as a Quaker volunteer in Kenya. In the 70s and 80s, he served in the UNDP, which is the UN Development Program, in Malaysia, Singapore, Brunei, Indonesia, and other countries. In 1981, he went to New York, where he helped set up the first roundtable meetings of the UNDP for Asia. He worked up through the UNDP, becoming deputy director and then chef de cabinet. In 1994, he became the assistant secretary general for human resources management, in charge of the management of 15,000 UN staff around the world. Secretary General Kofi Annan, in 1997, appointed him chief UN humanitarian coordinator for Iraq. He was in charge of the UN sanctions program. After serving 34 years in the UN, he resigned his post in protest over the devastating effects the sanctions were having on the people of Iraq. Since that time, he has dedicated much of his time to exposing the real effects of the sanctions, hundreds of thousands of deaths, the destruction of a civil society, and a nation held hostage. In a time when elites and demagogues are literally calling for the destruction and the obliteration of the nation of Iraq, he has become one of the leading voices of compassion and reason. It's my pleasure to introduce Dennis Halliday.
It's good to be with you, and it's good to talk again and try to have a dialogue. Because, you know, I'm not an expert. I don't have the answers. But maybe together we have some thoughts that would be useful for you and for me both. And I would like to speak briefly and try to keep me to that, and then let's have a discussion. Because the world, unfortunately, seems to be in chaos. I mean, it gets worse almost day by day. In the last discussion we had, somebody made the point, you know, where do we go next? Well, I wish I had the answers. You look at Israel and Palestine, and it just makes you weep what is happening to innocent people in Israel and innocent people in Palestine. It just makes no sense. But tonight I am here to speak about Iraq and terrorism, perhaps, and what happens next. And the question is, you know, is Iraq, or when is Iraq, going to be attacked by the United States? Well, I very much hope the answer is never. But as Sami Khan has just indicated, it looks like it may be sometime soon. The other day, the Secretary General, speaking in Oslo, accepting his Nobel Peace Prize, said that attacking Iraq would be unwise. Well, that's a very gentle term. It's not the term I would want to use. But he did go on to say something, I think, more appropriate, which is that the United States, alone or as a coalition, it cannot legally attack Iraq in any connection, including a terrorist connection, without a discussion by the Security Council of the United Nations under Chapter 7, Article 42. That's the provision that authorizes a member state or a coalition of member states, or the United Nations maybe itself, to undertake some sort of military action, such as George Bush the First assembled for the Gulf War itself. So that's an important point he has made. But just very quickly to go back to the history of Iraq, and I'm not going all the way back to Mesopotamia, but those of you who have been there and have been to Basra and seen the calamity of what's happened there and the use of depleted uranium in the Gulf War and some of the terrible things that were undertaken and the consequences on the people and the children of Basra. Then you drive a little to the west and you come to the ancient city of Ur, where the kings of Iraq or Mesopotamia once resided, where there are extraordinary, the ziggurat is there. And of course, they will show you the very house where Abraham lived himself for a particular period. Well, I don't know whether he did or not, but he certainly passed through on his way, I guess, to Palestine for that matter. But it's the contrast is quite awful. And you ask yourself, what on earth have we done to this modern state that is based on an ancient state of Mesopotamia between the Tigris and the Euphrates? Why have we done it? What have we done? And how do we justify it? And of course, there is no appropriate justification. More recent times, we very much involved in the development of modern Iraq. We, in the days of the great fear of the communist movement, we suppressed with great violence. We assisted the Ba'ath Party to suppress the communist party of Iraq with huge loss of life. We assisted the Ba'ath Party to power. We then were very happy when Saddam Hussein, threatened by Khomeini, took on Iran. That was really quite convenient. We had the bad experience of the hostages. I think those of us who were old enough remember that. And we supported Iraq. And we thought Iraq was going to lose that war. We supported them even more. Not only did we give them military intelligence, but we sold them, as you know, biological warfare capacity from a laboratory in Maryland. We in Europe, the Germans in particular, sold chemical weapons to Iraq, used, of course, against the Iranians. And generally, we indulged ourselves in having the Iraqis take on this horrendous war with staggering loss of life. When that war came to an end, what was it, 88? Iraq was bankrupt. They owed $70 billion. And the recovery period then began. And it was undermined very quickly by the Saudis and the Kuwaitis, who decided to overproduce oil and thereby crush the price of oil, thereby denying Iraq an income adequate to begin the process of recovery, reconstruction, and repayment of the $70 billion or $30 billion they owe to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait alone. On top of that, there were difficulties with the Shatt al-Arab and difficulties with access to the Gulf. There were even accusations of Kuwaiti slant-drilling oil wells, which were in Iraqi territory. In one way or the other, Iraq made a tragic mistake in breach of international law, for which they must take full responsibility, and invaded Kuwait. Now, Kuwait may well have been an integral part of Mesopotamia and Iraq for 5,000 years, but they are nevertheless an independent state since 1961, thanks to the British, and have to be respected as such. Iraq did not do that. That's unforgivable. Immediately, sanctions began. Sanctions of 1990, August 1990, I guess, which was a devastating, comprehensive regime of sanctions which stopped all exports of oil, all income. And this was in a country that in those days imported 70% of its foodstuffs. Well, you can imagine the consequences of that. But regardless, while the dialogue was continuing and the Arab League was trying to find a solution and everybody was trying to get Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait without too much loss of face, and those of you familiar with the Arab world understand the importance of dignity and sovereignty and face and humiliation. And that was not accomplished, unfortunately. And while the Security Council was sitting in New York and discussing the withdrawal of Iraq peacefully, the story goes one of the UN guards came in and said to the chairman or the president, You know, maybe you'd want to turn on CNN, because the United States has already begun its bombing attack on Baghdad. Well, many of us, you know, watched that, I imagine, and saw exactly what was happening. It would seem at that time that war was, in fact, what was wanted. You know, you'd wonder why. Well, the fact is, despite the Iran-Iraq war and the terrible consequences, Saddam Hussein, Iraq still showed potential for regional leadership. The oil supply, of course, but also the wherewithal. And that was a dangerous concept, a dangerous phenomenon for the United States, who had clear ambitions to control the Middle East for various reasons, including, of course, access to cheap oil. Now, the responsibility must rest with Baghdad for the invasion of Kuwait. Unacceptable. But the price, that is something else. And the price, of course, was a second round of sanctions in 1991, built on top of the Gulf War itself. And as you know, the Gulf War resulted in the dropping of ordnance on Iraq in greater quantity than all of the ordnance dropped in the Second World War, if you can imagine that volume. It resulted in many deaths. Perhaps 200,000 people died during the Gulf War period. It resulted in huge damage to the civilian infrastructure of Iraq. There are papers in Washington which show that a study was undertaken that if we're going to bring down this government, we're going to have to get the people to stand up and make a change, demand a change. And one way to do that is to make life so unbearable that the Iraqis will indeed do that. And one way to do that is to destroy the capacity of Iraq to have electric power, to treat and distribute water, clean drinking water, and to undermine the sanitation systems. Now, when you combine those three factors in a country of 22 million, in a country of urban dwellers, some 65% of Iraqis live in towns and cities, you have driven this country back into the Stone Age. I think that was the term used by Martti Ahtisaari, who then became the president of Finland when he did the first visit to Iraq to see the consequences of the Gulf War. We created chaos and appalling death amongst people, and children in particular, of course, who drank untreated water and died of then waterborne disease, as they have been dying ever since, right down to today and undoubtedly until tomorrow. The bombing of civilian infrastructure in a war is, in fact, in breach of the Geneva Conventions and Protocols, but it was in a deliberate intention to disrupt, destroy Iraq and bring about change. That, of course, did not work. So what have we seen since? Well, we've seen the continued punishment of a people for crimes that they did not commit, were not responsible for, were not consulted, clearly, vis-a-vis the invasion of Kuwait. We've seen disproportionate punishment. The fact the 1991 sanctions regime, which is grossly comprehensive, uniquely comprehensive, there's nothing else like it before or since, fortunately, was out of proportion to the target. The target now was not Iraq out of Kuwait. That had been accomplished, unfortunately, by military endeavors and dreadful cost of life, but was to force Iraq to disarm. A perfectly viable, valid process, in my view, but not under the process of the comprehensive embargo. There is a rule in international law of proportionality. The Oil for Food program was established then in the mid-90s. Under pressure, the Security Council felt that they had to do something about the consequences of the embargo. The reports were, of course, coming in. They began to understand just exactly what was happening in Iraq under the embargo. Resources had run out, imports had run out, the stores of medical supplies had run out. Things were very bad. And it took some years for the Iraqis to back down and swallow their sovereignty and to accept the strings and conditions attached to that program. It was finally signed in 96, implemented in the beginning of 97, and I volunteered to run that program myself in 97 and was allowed to leave New York by Kofi Annan in the middle of 97 to do that. You know, why on earth did I think I was competent? Well, it's a very good question. I think because I spent 30 years in the development business and I thought maybe I could do something about it. Of course, I found out very quickly this was a humanitarian program. This was a program designed not to resolve the issue, but to sustain, in fact, Iraq at a level of subsistence living that I discovered very quickly constituted famine conditions. And that really has not changed a great deal if you look at the mortality rates for young children that UNICEF publishes. The Oil for Food program allowed Iraq to sell a certain amount of oil, the revenue of which went into the coffers of the United Nations, We took 35% off that gross, 5% for overheads, 30% for compensation through a fund designed to compensate countries that lost real estate, property, whatever, damage in Kuwait due to the invasion and destruction of some aspects of Kuwait. The balance then was used for contracts that Iraq negotiated, contracts approved by the United Nations 661 Committee, and mainly, initially, particularly given the limited resources, dealing with food, a basic food basket, but absent of any animal proteins or vitamins, minerals essential for the well-being of human beings, and other minimal pharmaceutical supplies, some equipment also for the agricultural sector, and very little for anything else other than perhaps education. But the amount of money available, I think, ran at about $1.6 billion for 6 months. Well, you divide $22 million into $1.6 billion every 6 months, and you can work it out for yourself. It doesn't buy a great deal of food or anything else, frankly. And the principle of sustaining a people in their own country with their own money in these conditions is, you know, hard to accept, considering it came from the United Nations. The people who are built and are sitting on the charter, the foundation of the United Nations, who are dedicated to Eleanor Roosevelt's Human Rights Declaration and so on. I mean, it's unbelievable when you think it through, the system that was set up. But nevertheless, I took it on. I found very quickly this was not working. Something had to be done. We discussed with New York. I got no support. So I went to the Russians and the French and the Chinese, who were represented in Baghdad. And we set about the process of getting the Security Council to agree to change the program. So we took it, in fact, from $4 billion gross per year to $10 billion gross per year. That's a lot of money, minus 35%, of course. Plus, you have 22 million population. Plus, you have the Gulf War damage. And you have a population already heavily into anemia, malnourishment, and all of the other social collapses that these conditions bring upon a people. And they are quite extraordinary. In addition to that, we impose the same regime on our Kurdish friends in the north, who are also, of course, Iraqis first and Kurdish second. They are extraordinary and wonderful people. I was there last May. I met with Mr. Barzani and Mr. Talabani, the two Kurdish leaders. We talked about relations with Baghdad, what we could do to help. I was with Mr. von Sponik, the man who replaced me ultimately in Iraq, to see how we could help Baghdad and the Kurds to negotiate autonomy and try to bring this country back together. Because the Kurds and the economy of the Kurds, which is agricultural, is an essential part of the recovery of Iraq. But in fact, I'm jumping ahead. But the fact, my point was that this dreadful embargo also killed Kurdish children just as much as it killed Arab, Iraqi children in the south of the country. Now, the reality is that this embargo did everything that we didn't perhaps want to accomplish. It strengthened the Baghdad regime. It made it totally powerful and centralized. It demolished the professional middle classes, the educated, the men and women who'd worked in Britain or North America, doctors, scientists, educators, civil servants, the very people who were interested in governance, the very people who undoubtedly wanted a participatory democratic system in Iraq, were hit perhaps most severely, other than the very poor, immediately, because their income was reduced overnight, something like 900% devaluation and so on, a massive change of revenue. So a professor who may have made $3,000 or $4,000 a month and lived well in Iraq on that sort of income, suddenly found himself or herself making $10 a month. And $10 does not go very far. Believe me, even in Iraq, when you do have the Oil for Food program handouts, this food basket, as we call it, when chicken is still a couple of dollars a kilo and bananas are $1.50 a kilo. I mean, it just doesn't add up. And how do Iraqis survive? Well, of course, they've sold many of their belongings, their homes, their furniture, their cars, their TVs, their books. And of course, many are living on receipts, as people do in Haiti or Cuba, and now, of course, in Iraq and the Kurdish north as well. Iraqis overseas, and there are possibly 2 or 3 million overseas, send money home to help their families survive this very bad period. So we've not accomplished any change. We've punished the people for crimes they did not commit, and we now find ourselves, after 11 years, with basically no progress. In fact, we're perhaps going backwards, because thanks to Richard Butler and his report in November of 1998, when he reported that Iraq was certainly collaborating but had some shortfall, it justified the then attack. I think it's called Desert Fox. I call it the pre-Ramadan attack of December 98, when Iraq was bombed afresh. And the withdrawal of inspectors was the initiative of the UN, of Richard Butler, not of the Iraqi government. And of course, this has made Iraq vulnerable, because now we can say we have no inspectors, so we don't know what you've been doing for 3 years. They, for domestic political reasons, and for reasons I think of justice, feel it's too late. You cannot now demand a return of your inspectors when you are not prepared to give us anything in return. And they have gone public quite clearly, quite often. If you lift the economic embargo, if you allow our people to live, and that's really what we're talking about, living, surviving, staying alive, we will allow UN monitoring and inspections of our weapons capacity. We forget that, but that in fact is the offer on the table. We have not taken that up, and one of the difficulties we face in the United Nations, in the Security Council, is that the United States has another policy, which does not appear in the UN books, but says basically, as long as Saddam Hussein is in power, we will never lift the economic embargo. So we have a huge impasse, and we certainly have a device which does not, I would say, encourage cooperation on the part of Baghdad. More recently, we've been talking about smart sanctions. Well, smart sanctions, like sanctions themselves, are legitimate under the UN Charter. As I said, I think, Chapter 7, Article 41. They look good up front, and maybe they would have been good back in 1991. Smart sanctions in 91 would have focused the embargo on the regime, the government in Baghdad, on the decision makers, on the men and women who made the mistakes, who committed the crimes of invading Kuwait, for example, and perhaps dealt with their finances, their travel, their privileges, the things that people in government like to enjoy. But, you know, to introduce that now is too late and too little. And the package that von Sponeck and I both attacked in May and June of this year, past year, was much more than just what I've described. It was another device to close down the border traffic between Turkey, Jordan, and Syria, and Iraq. Now, if you look at the charter, under a sanctions regime, third countries, that is, those neighboring countries, are entitled to compensation for the price they must pay for the embargo imposed on their neighbor, their trading partner. And of course, Turkey and Jordan in particular, and Syria to a lesser extent in Iran, have suffered quite considerably because of the embargo on Iraq. So this cross-border traffic is well monitored by satellite and is well known. I've been up there myself many times. There are sometimes 15 kilometers of trucks coming into Iraq from Turkey with food, pharmaceuticals, things of that sort, and then going back with gasoline for sale in Turkey. And it's, you know, it's illegal, but it's recognized and endorsed by the United States. After all, Turkey is a NATO ally. It's even more critical with Jordan, because Jordan is a very weak economy, 30% unemployment, and cross-border trade is just terribly important to the well-being of the economy and the employment of hundreds of thousands of people. Likewise, to a lesser extent, with Syria. So this was a disastrous process. And happily, Turkey, Syria, Jordan complained to the United Nations and said they could not, would not accept this smart sanctions package for the closure of the border. It just would crush their economies. So that failed, and it's failed again. And now we have another process. We have a technical rollover of the program, and we'll see what happens next June. Meantime, life for the Iraqi people has not changed. The sense of where's the light at the end of the tunnel, the sense of hope. I was there recently, earlier this year, with an Irish television team, and we visited the very poor. We went to the slum areas. It was an extraordinary visit. We went then to a prosperous middle-class family, two professionally qualified, a couple, three wonderful kids who all played musical instruments. And they were asked, you know, what's the impact of you on what's the impact on your family of the sanctions regime? They didn't talk about starvation or malnutrition or anemia or even lack of food. They talked about hope, hopes for their future, opportunities, education. Why should our children be punished? Why can't they have a proper life? Why must they pay the price of the mistakes of our government? So there's a whole different levels of pain and anguish and despair in Iraq under the present regime. So I don't think smart sanctions are going to fly. Something else has got to be accomplished. And now, of course, given the disaster and the catastrophe of 11 September, things again have changed for the worse vis-a-vis Iraq. another tragedy, another punishment of the Iraqi people, for which I think there's no justification. And, you know, I walk through Grand Central sometimes. I take the subway downtown. I live up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And I go to that notice board, and it just breaks your heart to this day to see signs which say things like, "Have you seen Tom Smith, my fiancé?" People are still hoping that somehow a miracle will happen and the lost loved one will somehow appear. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. But what is more difficult to understand and to feel the same depth of sympathy is that this is what's happening every day in countries like Iraq, in places like Palestine, in places like Israel, and now, of course, in Afghanistan, and in fact, in many other places, but let's focus on the Middle East. We have got to somehow stand in the shoes of those who suffer like this every day. We've got to begin to understand the vulnerability that perhaps we now feel here in New York in particular, or in this country, given the terrorist attack, and given that great fear that it can happen again tomorrow, next week, whenever. Because for many people around the world, the 2 billion in poverty, the people who suffer in Palestine or Iraq, they feel this every day. This is their life, that vulnerability, that loss of life, that loss of a child. We really need to, I think, identify with that. And if we do that, and if we can do that, knowing that they are actually the same as we are, we, I think, have got to make sure that most Americans understand that. Because I believe most Americans do not understand that. And despite the great democracy of this country, the media is not, in my view, serving this great democracy. Americans do not, unfortunately, know. And you know, that is extraordinary. I don't know how you deal with it up here. I watch the BBC sometimes in New York in the evenings just to see the other side of the story, and it's quite alarming. There is another side, and you know, I believe that the American population deserves to get both sides. I mean, the implication is that Washington thinks that Americans are basically so stupid they can't understand or they can't make up their own decision. That's nonsense. That really is nonsense. And it's a dangerous, I think, perception of the American population. And I understand Mr. Ashcroft, I mean, despite my bottle of Coke, he may not be doing so well as he was a couple of weeks ago. People are beginning to say, well, you know, civil liberties do count. I don't want to give them up. If we give them up, we're doing exactly what Mr. Bush said we shouldn't do. We're allowing the terrorists to impact on our lives. And, you know, civil liberties, because we don't think about it every day, because it doesn't, we're not threatened every day. But some of us may someday be threatened, and that's a very loss, serious loss of rights. You know, our fundamental human rights in this country are largely a given. Most of us have all the things that fundamental human rights provide: housing, income, employment, healthcare, all that stuff. Although it always astonishes me that 20% of American kids go to bed hungry every night. That's a human right that's being denied. Or 45 million Americans don't have proper health care coverage. That's a human right being denied. There are homeless people in New York. If you come to Manhattan, you probably not here, but we have the homeless. That's a human right denied. Astonishing in the richest country on earth. But let's not get into the soft side of American democracy. Let's go back to Iraq. The fact is, there seems to be huge pressure in Washington. And as soon as I'm an old man myself, I can now say it's the old men in Washington who are putting pressure, I believe, on the younger president to finish off the job that they feel was not finished in 1991. Well, I hate that expression. There was no job to finish off. But nevertheless, that perhaps is the perception. And therefore, to go back in and destroy Iraq or bomb Iraq or whatever is in mind is disgusting. It's, of course, in breach of international law, unless the UN is somehow, hopefully not, dragged in to support it. But I think the people like Cheney and Rumsfeld just feel, and others who I won't mention, so to speak, are committed. And that's a problem. But it looks like they, in fact, cannot find the evidence. There is, apparently, no evidence that Iraq has harbored terrorism or is involved in terrorism. You know, we may not like the regime. We don't like their reputation, their actions on human rights. There's a whole bunch of things we don't like about Iraq. And happily, they accept the criticism. I mean, they certainly get it from me on a regular basis. And they get it from many others, too, I'm sure. But the fact is, the Iraqis are afraid of terrorism just like we are. They are surrounded, perhaps they feel surrounded by sort of fundamentalist Islamic right thinking. It makes them very nervous. They are a secular state. There's no way that Mr. bin Laden and Mr. Saddam Hussein would sit down and agree, I think, on any sort of comparable. It's just, they're too foreign to each other. It's just not conceivable. To those of you who understand that world, I think you would agree. If you don't, you must say so later. In fact, there's legislation in Iraq. There's a capital price to be paid in Iraq for those who preach the Saudi Wahhab form of Sunni Islam, because it's seen to be a dangerous fundamentalist line of thought, which leads to the Al-Qaeda sort of terrorist approach to life. So, I mean, there's no way, in my view, this is going to happen. So I think we've seen a realization, and I gather just today there's legislation going through the committee stage in Washington whereby a new rationale will be found to attack Iraq, and that will be the fact that the weapons industry of Iraq has not been inspected for 3 years. And there's some dreadful suspicion that they may have put together all sorts of terrible things. Now, this is sort of strange because, you know, when Mr. Cohen, the outgoing, Secretary of War, but I mean Secretary of Defense, when he left, he said quite clearly, Iraq presents no danger to its neighbors, nor, of course, to the United States. Mr. Powell recently announced that Iraq presents no danger to its neighbors, the United States. And Mr. Scott Ritter, who was an inspector for 7 years and who really knows that country, I mean, he would excuse me for saying that he was one of the most obnoxious UN inspectors in the entire country. He and I actually met in Washington. We never acknowledged each other in Iraq. He, in his own manner, of actually great integrity, I do respect him, pursued the Iraqi programs of biological, chemical warfare, whatever, with great thoroughness. He says today, the United Nations destroyed every manufacturing production capacity that existed in Iraq. And that means, you know, hundreds of thousands of weapons were blown up. All the long-range missiles were destroyed. I've forgotten 97 of them or something like that. All the manufacturing plants for baby food, milk products, pharmaceuticals, fertilizer, pesticides, food processing, I'm sure I'm missing a few things, but anything that could be remotely used for weapons production of any sort, destroyed. After having destroyed the building, they then poured liquid cement into the pipes and the drainage system. I mean, it's total destruction. None of that's been rebuilt. There is no basis, Scott says, to believe that Iraq has new capacity. The IAEA, the Atomic Energy Agency, was there this year in the nuclear context and giving Iraq, I believe, a clean bill of health in the nuclear capability area. But of course, undoubtedly, there is a residue of perhaps chemical, biological weapons. I mean, you know, we have to face up to the realities. I don't need to remind you, was it this week or last week, the United States walked out of the discussions on the Convention on Germ Warfare. Today in the New York Times, there's a piece on the top left column about the fact that here in these states, we've been manufacturing anthrax for years. Well, you know, there was a 1969 convention that I think says that is not allowed. So, you know, the reason we don't want to participate in this particular aspect of international law is that the United States does not want, understandably, UN inspectors going through the United States and just looking at chemical and biological warfare capacity production. Just as Saddam Hussein, after 7 years, feels he's had enough of it also. You know, we really need to look at double standards here. We've got to deal with others as we like to be dealt with ourselves. We either buy into international law or we don't. And I think there's a huge problem in this country, and it's another topic I shouldn't get into. But I think it's a great concern for many of us that the U.S. is not ready to buy into international law. The U.S. uses the United Nations as part of its foreign affairs. It's a tool of U.S. foreign affairs. It rejects, I don't need to tell you, Kyoto, ICC, Law of the Sea, Rights of the Child. I mean, it's a long, horrible list, and it's a very dangerous phenomenon because it says, in my view, that the great democracy in this world, the greatest, most powerful country, somehow rejects international law, rejects setting up standards which we should all abide by. That's a problem, a very serious one, I believe. Well, you know, here we go again. So we're going to go back into Iraq and destroy Iraq. You know, why? Well, I suspect there's still this anxiety that Saddam Hussein has potential for regional leadership. It's hard to see it. But the fact is, the Arab street, as it's called, believes this man is the only Arab leader with enough guts to actually snub his nose at the UN and the US. That's unfortunate, perhaps, but that is a reality. And the governments of the rest of the Arab world, you know, they're in our pocket, let's face it. We bought them some time ago. So who is there to turn to? We have presented, in a sense, a man like Saddam Hussein with a gift. That is the support of the Arab community, the people in the street. And but to be fair, we're seeing, I think, indications that the Saudis, for example, are listening to the people in the street, because they have already said they will not support, at least not actively, a U.S. bombing attack on Iraq. That's a good sign, as has, I think, most of the Arab League. Do we really believe that might is right? Well, you know, it's hard to believe that. We still abide by the might is right concept. It's like the just war concept. I mean, to me, it's quite foreign. But, you know, might seems to be right. Somebody said the other day, you know, we're on a roll, folks. We've got Afghanistan on its knees. Let's take out Iraq. Or let's take out Somalia first, maybe, but then let's take out Iraq. I mean, this is bizarre stuff. And what else is there? Well, it's oil. Maybe it's oil, price of oil, the control of oil. Maybe it's fear of an old friend, an old ally. Actually, we work very closely with Saddam Hussein, as you know. Something has gone wrong. And it's I think it's a very dangerous thing for this country. Of course, the Iraqi people who will be killed, but for this country. Because this country needs the credibility, the leadership. It needs to realize the potential for good that this country uniquely has. And that's one of the most upsetting things for me living in this country, to see the potential and see the potential not being realized. It's really very painful. Well, I should move on. I'm sure I'm talking too much as usual. But I just want to give you some alternatives, because I can't leave you sort of high and dry here. And the alternative to sanctions would seem to me to be dialogue. I mean, Clinton, you know, for all his skills and faults together, perhaps, opened a dialogue with North Korea. Quite remarkable. And we saw good things happen. Mr. Bush hasn't helped recently, but, you know, maybe he'll change on that front also. We need to end the isolation and alienation of Iraq and countries like Iraq. That is counterproductive. You know, you want to work, live together. You isolate somebody, the youth of Iraq feel rejected, alienated, from their own neighborhood and from the West in particular. Tariq Aziz has been quoted as saying, well, if you think we're difficult to deal with, wait till you meet the next round, because they've never been to the West or to the United States. It's going to be much more difficult. We need to invite the Iraqis, in my view, or have the Arab world invite the Iraqis to join a coalition against terrorism. As I said, it worries them as much as it worries us. That perhaps would be helpful. We need to stop the bombing of Iraq. Even the Secretary General, cautious man though he is, has said, I think, once or twice, bombing Iraq by the United States and Britain is illegal. There is no resolution that authorizes that. It's very destructive and counterproductive. We've got to stop the demonization of Saddam Hussein. You know, we've convinced ourselves that there are 22 million Saddam Husseins. That's crazy. The Iraqis see it differently. They see a clear distinction between individual Americans and Washington. They're more sophisticated than we are. We need to get those UN inspectors back in there. Absolutely. But to do that, of course, we've got to lift the economic embargo. That's the trade-off. That allows, I think, Baghdad to look its own people in the face and say, look, we're humiliated, we've been humiliated on several counts. We've got to face up the fact these inspections are essential to the well-being of this country. But at least we're getting rid of the economic embargo. We can begin the process, 10, 15-year process maybe, $100 billion of investment to get this country back on its feet. We've got to do, I think, a number of things. We've got to end our practice of double standards. We've got to export democracy by deeds. We've got to really show that we mean what we say when we talk about democracy. We've got to respect international law. As I said, I think we've got to embargo ourselves in respect of the arms trade. Terrorism, well, we've got to understand why it happens. The debt, the poverty, the imposition of our standards, the imposition of our military, the interference in the lifestyle of other peoples, not moving at their pace, not respecting their religious, ethnic views. That just clearly needs to be addressed. We've got to recognize that some of the things we find unacceptable, like suicide bombings, are really not much different from the Christian approach to the just war, laying down your life for your faith, laying down your life for your nation. I remember the cardinals in St. Patrick's Cathedral standing up and defending the good fight against the threat of communism in Southeast Asia. I'm sure you do also. And as I said before, you know, Americans are not hated. Let's not fool ourselves. This is not true. Our civilization is not the source of great fear. It's our interference. It's our transfer of that into a policy which upsets and undermines the well-being of other countries. That we've got to deal with here. And those of you who really care have got to find a way to use it effectively. The fact that the rest of the world has no courage and doesn't have the guts to stand up and address the issue is something else. And I believe the only way for Washington to be influenced is by good people like yourselves, who believe democracy can indeed work, and also by the allies and friends of the United States who've got to stand up as friends and say to Mr. Bush, look, this is not working. You are destroying the credibility of your own country. You're undermining your own leadership. You're undermining the best interests, the vested interests of the United States. And with that, I'll stop and let's have a discussion.
Your last point is what my question is about. Why is the rest of the world tolerating U.S. military adventurism time after time? And what is it going to take for the rest of the world to realize that they've got to get this under control? They've got to stand up to it. I see it as frighteningly similar to what went on just before what we called World War II in the Far East with Japan and in Europe with Germany.
Well, even the powerful countries outside of the United States, I mean, you know this better than I, whether we're talking about China or Russia or most of the European powers, everybody wants something from the great superpower. The economic well-being of this country is just overwhelming. And those who don't, as Mr. Bush has said very clearly, what did he say? You're either with us on terrorism or you're against us. There's no middle ground, something like that. Well, that seems to be working. I mean, the fact is that the world is afraid. I mean, we don't think of the United States as a frightening. You do, and you're Americans. But I think much of the world, you know, sadly sees it like that, and the courage to do something about it is missing. The need to collaborate with the U.S. is just overwhelming. My own country, Ireland. I mean, I've gone on record, I'm sure it irritates the government terribly. A, they failed totally as president of the Security Council. They never even demanded a discussion as to why we had a terrorist attack on the Twin Towers. But they've also sold the country to the United States. The economy of Ireland and its prosperity rests on American investment. Well, that makes you pretty vulnerable. So when we have St. Patrick's Day, I mean, which is not neither here nor there, really, but where is the Prime Minister of Ireland? Is he back in the old country, you know? No, he's in the White House. Well, that tells you something. And I think we're all in bed with Washington. I mean, it's very crowded, but we're all there. And that's a problem. And I don't know the answer to it. There is no answer to it. I mean, I don't like the idea of building a new power bloc in Europe. You know, that's not healthy. But it may be the only sort of influential force, in a positive sense, to sort of help Washington to come up with approaches and solutions that are more, I think, human, at least sensitive, something like that. It wasn't a very good answer. I'm doing my best. But. Anybody else? You don't have to ask a question. Make a comment. I mean, you're most welcome. Sir. Oh, yes. Right. That's right. That's right. Well, I mean, Amy Goodman had me on, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I've been on that show many times. She's just an extraordinary character. Did she graduate from Ithaca College? She and I once disrupted the UN Security Council, actually. She was talking about Timor, and I was talking about reform of the United Nations. But I was on recently, and she asked me, she played an interview she had with Bill Clinton, much to her surprise, and he said, well, you know, as you say, $40 billion in 4 years. What's the problem here, folks? Well, you know, sounds good. Well, when you break down that $40 billion, well, today actually it's $44 billion of oil has been sold by the Iraqis since the beginning of 1997. $44 billion. But as I said, 35% came off the top. That cuts it down by a fair bit. Then there's $4.2 billion, which is on hold, largely by the initiative of Washington and London. These are dual purpose. These are contracts. These are chlorine gas. I mean, a whole range of goods and things, which, of course, can be used for two purposes. I mean, a truck can be used for shipping goods, or a truck can be used for shipping military. So you have this huge problem. But $4.2 billion is sitting there doing nothing. You've got another 3 or so billion sitting idle in the accounts in Paris. You've got another 4 or 5 billion in transit. The result of all this is that in as of now, last week literally I think it is, Iraq has received about $14 billion worth of goods, foodstuffs, medicines, pharmaceuticals, equipment for various sectors. Now again, a lot of that is not food, but if you divide that by 22 million, you know, it adds up actually to very little money. I think it's about $170 per person per year. Well, that's not a serious input to a country that's been devastated by a war and lived under 10 years of sanctions. So Mr. Clinton repeats this misinformation, just like Mr. George Bush talks about incubators in Kuwait being, you know, babies being thrown on the floor and incubators being thrown out the window. Absolute rubbish put out by a public relations company. You know, we have this misinformation. It's very hard to correct. One tries, but it sticks.
Given your many years of experience at the UN, I was wondering what you feel are specific tools that the UN could use to contain what most of us probably perceive as American arrogance and believing that they can just do whatever they want in any country they want.
Yeah, I think the answer to that issue lies within the United States. And there are people in Washington, and there are articles have been written, and I mentioned one today, I think it's in the Foreign Affairs Journal of April, May, the year 2000. I've forgotten the author, but it explains why the United States should participate in the United Nations, why the United States should begin to work with international law, why the United States should be a part of the community and not an independent empire subject to a law of empire that only applies to the United States and not to everybody else. So there are people already worrying that what's happening is not in the interest of the United States, that the U.S., no matter how powerful, cannot take on the role of global policeman. I mean, it's just not viable. I think many in Washington feel that way. You need the United Nations. We need effective peacekeeping. We need the financial resources of the United States and so on. We need the respect of the United States. So we don't have bypassing into Kosovo through NATO. We don't venture into Afghanistan without, in fact, Security Council endorsement. Article 51 does not, in fact, authorize an aggressive action against a sovereign state. It talks about self-defense. It's a real stretch to call the attack on Afghanistan and whatever's happened there has been consistent with Article 51. So we need a new approach, and I think it has to come from within, and a realization that this actually serves the United States. I mean, that is the key, it seems to me, to change the best interest of the United States. And what that means, it's like the vulnerability issue. The fact that many Americans now feel vulnerable, I think is the time to turn that vulnerability into something positive. The fact that unless people around the world, particularly people in the world of desperation, of fear, unless they feel safe, we are never going to be free of terrorism. If they're not safe, we're not going to be safe. It's as simple as that. And that has to be dealt with on a whole range of fronts, whether it's IMF policy, or U.S. policy, or U.N. policy. You know, there's a lot of work to be done.
Why would it be a mistake for there to be a European counterpower? Why do we always have to flatter this great, powerful United States? I don't think it's such a great thing to be that powerful. I don't think any country can handle that kind of power. And why do we always have to flatter power? And if indeed the Europeans, let's say those who need something, let's say France, they talk and then they give in, they talk big and then they give in, Germany. So they obviously need something from the U.S. too. But knowing that they sell themselves out, I mean, there must be part of them that doesn't like what's going on, but they must know they're prostituting themselves.
No, deep down, we love you. We just can't get over it. I don't know. There's many reasons. I mean, you know, we Irish claim that 40 million Americans are Irish. So, you know, we obviously love you. But, I think I think many of us are reluctant to see another, you know, power block. That's really not the way the world's supposed to work anymore. But, you know, it looks like it's perhaps inevitable. And the UN talks about regional groupings for peacekeeping, for example, which I'm not sure I quite buy into. But nevertheless, you know, in Europe, we're having a real struggle with ourselves. I think you're probably aware of that. Ireland, we did the terrible thing. We shot down the Nice Treaty because many of us are against the militarization of Europe. I mean, I would want to abolish NATO, as a matter of fact, and a few other things. But, you know, we're having a real struggle. And we're all finding, hey, this thing is serious. You know, Brussels is stomping all over us. I guess it's like the federal government vis-a-vis the states, states' rights and states' government. And, I mean, you know all about this here in this country. So we're under a huge period of adjustment. So there is no foreign policy of the EU, per se. We haven't quite got that point yet. And maybe we will, and maybe we should, and maybe you're right. But, you know, it's going to take some time. But I would like to think that the European group and many others, and it should be, it's not just a North-South thing, it's not a G7 thing, but, you know, there are friends of the United States all over the world. And if we, you know, we need to work with each other. I mean, I sincerely believe that the U.S. will listen to its allies more than anybody else. And it's up to the allies then to stand up and be counted. And that's, I think, where we have to put a little pressure.
The fact that Bush needed the British and the French and so on to say, yes, go ahead and bomb Afghanistan. Isn't that going to give them some leverage in terms of talking about Kyoto or talking about the missile shield and so on? Do you think Tony Blair said, when this is all over, we're going to sit down and talk about some other things?
I don't think so. No. I think that you may have noticed a sort of a drop in the relationship a little bit there, like two lovers who sort of, something didn't work out. I mean, Mr. Blair's been very quiet. I think he's a little bit hurt that his troops haven't been used, that his advice hasn't been taken. You know, it's not working out. And Mr. Blair actually has said, I think, fairly clearly at one stage that, you know, there's no justification to attack Iraq in the context of terrorism. So it's a strange relationship. I think at the end of the day, given the domestic pressures Mr. Bush is under and the stress of, you know, representing God, And having the support of 91% of the American population, that's a very powerful mix. Why should he worry about Tony Blair? Let's face it. Tony Blair, who has no standing in Europe whatsoever. I mean, it's a strange relationship. But, you know, one can't give up. Because I like to think that Tony Blair and Bush, or Clinton before him, they should be able to work out some sensible solutions to some of the world's problems.
Second point, I realize this is sort of a moot historical, but for the point of historical accuracy, even though it seems like a rather moot point at this point, my reading on the Iraq war at the time was that our ambassador, April Glaspie, had given tacit permission to Hussein to cross the border. Did she not say, we have no opinion on this matter about whether you invade Kuwait? No, it never gets talked about. And I'm like, where's someone I can ask this question of? It was in the New York Times.
Well, a friend of mine has edited a book called, Phyllis Bennis is her name. It's called, I think, the Gulf War. But the entire discussion between April Glaspie and the president of Iraq is there, word for word. So you can read it for yourself. It's in any good library. I'm sure it's in Ithaca College. But it should be. But it does. It's an ambiguous sort of statement. It seemed to say, well, you know, we don't want to get into your regional stuff. But, you know, at the same time, and I have seen this, and I don't have a copy. I think it was the Los Angeles Times, sorry, had a headline. It said something like, oh my God, he's taken the whole damn country. The thought apparently was that Iraq would take the oil field, the Rumallah oil field, which is on the border with Kuwait. They were not actually going to Kuwait City. So maybe there's a misunderstanding. But, you know, I think General Schwarzkopf, I understand, was planning desert warfare and practicing before the invasion of Kuwait. So, you know, it raises some questions. But Ramsey Clark seems to know the answer. But, you know, I don't know the answer. But I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Yes. Is there any hope at all for Sabaya, or are they officially toast?
Yeah, well, I think it's in the Times today. No, it wasn't. I read an article by John Pilger. Pilger is this Australian Brit. He's the one who made the first documentary with me on Iraq and the sanctions and so on. His comment is, you know, Somalia? Is this about revenge for the tragedy of 18 Americans being, you know, very brutally killed? He thinks it may well be about that. Although already 10 to 15,000 Somalis have died. But nevertheless, I can't begin to understand why we'd go to Somalia. When somebody else, was it Mr. Rumsfeld, probably talked about going for the snake and taking off its head. Not a very nice way of putting things, but then he has this habit of not putting things very well. But where's the head of the snake? Well, you know, I don't want to point the finger at Saudi Arabia, but others might want to do that. I mean, you might want to look there first. That's where the money seems to be. You know, I'm not sure we're going in the right place. And if we really are committed, as we must be committed, it seems to me, to suppressing terrorism, and by legal means, by using international law and other devices, that's the only way it can be done, in my view. Then we need to look at the Saudis and everybody. We need to look at ourselves. Let's face it. This country. I mean, some in this room, and I would be among them, believe that the School of the Americas is a terrorist training camp.
Well, first, I want to say two things. First is thank you very much, because voices like your voice, or I'm from Spain, and some people bring us some hope. People like you or Garzón, I don't know, I guess you know, the Spanish judge who asked for Pinochet extradition to Spain, or now just denied the extradition of 11 possible terrorists to the States. I mean, people like you or like him bring us a lot of hope.
Yeah.
And that's very nice. And second is, as a European, I'm very concerned about, it would be possible for a European politician, for a European leader, to pull out of the NATO with not risking losing government, which it looks like it's what they are really scared of.
As I remember, the head of NATO is a...
He was a Spanish.
I was a Spanish. He's now head of...
He was a Spanish that actually went on the demonstrations in Spain against NATO in the referendum, you know, before the referendum in 1986.
Really?
So it's... he's actually the Mr. Pesk, we call him now. I don't know. He's supposed to be the guy in charge of the new European army whenever it
That's
comes.
That's right. No, I mean, this is the rapid reaction force. I mean, there's a huge debate in Europe about NATO and a rapid reaction force, which is a sort of a NATO-related endeavor for those of us who can't tolerate the thought of NATO, but nevertheless, our governments are sucking us into this thing, which is managed, planned, directed, whatever, by NATO, which many of us feel is a very frightening phenomenon, a danger to itself and to the world and to the UN in addition to that. Whether one country can break out, well, of course, you can do anything in theory, but in reality, there's a price. And I think my own country won't pay the price, because the fear is that Ireland is so into high-tech industry, American-funded, that the United States wouldn't allow Ireland to be outside of the NATO enclave, because that would be too risky. I mean, so we're all compromised. I mean, there's nothing new about that. It's like the fact that we now have Raytheon, known to some of you, I believe, around here. Raytheon has now moved into Derry in the north of Ireland, subsidized by the British government. And that was the reward for having the assistance of Edward Kennedy and Mr. Kerry in a very good move vis-a-vis the north, but we are certainly paying the price by being an arms producer in Ireland.
I have a question. Sanctions were imposed by Security Council, and that's the only organ of the UN which can lift them. I would just wonder whether there's any permanent member of the Security Council that is interested in lifting sanctions, and if there is, then what is their role of trade? That, you know, is trade an important factor in their interest?
Well, it was until recently very clear. France and Russia, and more or less supported by China, were very clear the economic sanctions should be lifted. And Britain and the United States took a different stance. That has now been weakened. China, as you know, wanted WTO membership, and there's a price to be paid for that. China now seems to have gone off the fence on the US side of that equation. The French, likewise, have turned their back on Iraq, and the Iraqis are very unhappy with that. And now Russia, although, as the New York Times said today, you know, why are we pushing the Russians so hard? I mean, giving up the ABM is really putting pressure on our new friend. But the Russians also have agreed to this technical rollover of the oil for food, and they've agreed to look at smart sanctions. Now, they haven't totally caved in. And if they do, you know, well, Iraq will have to bite the bullet. You know, we've got to find some way out of this thing. If there's an interim period of loss of dignity, pay it. It would be my advice to Iraq. But let's stop the killing of Iraqi children, Iraqi. That's the ugly and unacceptable part of it. But there is no easy way out. And it's difficult, I think, for the U.S. to back down after the demonization. And now compounded by the sort of Cheney, Wolfowitz, School of Rumsfeld and others, who are into this wretched terrorist attack program. we're going in the wrong direction. It's getting worse, not better. And that is very worrisome, I think, for all of us who care about the Iraqis and the price they've paid already, which is impossible to justify. So, I'm not optimistic about Security Council and the five permanent members, aka, you might say, G7.
Sorry, I'll make this really quick. But on the subject of sort of terrorist states, I was curious, I haven't heard you speak at all about depleted uranium in the two times I've heard you speak today. Uh-huh. I was wondering if you could speak about that a bit, because I guess I'm sort of worried about my own tax dollars being used for terrorism. And